This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Some personal questions for you. Have you ever had a fear of public speaking? Did you overcome that fear? If so, how? If not, would you like to? And how about if you not only could get completely comfortable standing up in front of an audience, but knew how to communicate in an especially effective manner? We've asked a psychologist, a communication researcher, and a former presidential debate coach to all pitch in this hour. So if not just fear-free, but stellar public speaking is on your wish list, do stay tuned. Today's Communication Focus begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number. Communication, our focus. And, oh, I have so many questions for you. Who is the most effective communicator you have ever seen? Have you ever been in an audience, large or small, and just found yourself wowed by the person standing in front speaking to you? What was it about her or him that impressed you so? How do you feel about speaking in public yourself? Would you, as some surveys of Americans seem to show, rather hang out with a whole bunch of really scary spiders instead of facing a microphone? Have any ideas on what works best to overcome fear of public speaking? If you've got thoughts to share or questions of your own, it's really easy to just speak on the phone. Please do call us at 888-967-2825. Later in the hour, we're going to meet up with a communication consultant who has coached a number of high-profile political candidates, including former President George W. Bush. But we begin with a communication scholar and a psychologist. Oral communication is one of Stephen Lin's areas of research. These days, he's also serving as visiting professor at Washington and Lee University. Dr. Lind, thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's exciting to be here talking about talking.
Craig Sheely is a clinical psychologist, a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison, and executive director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute. Dr. Sheely, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Great to see you.
Well, Stephen, I expect that Craig Sheely has some insight on this to offer, too, but let me go to you first, if I could, with what seems the most obvious question. Why do most people fear public speaking so much?
It's an important question because the fear of public speaking is a real fear, a profound fear. Studies routinely list public speaking as one of the top fears, along, up there with the fear of heights, the fear of spiders, the fear of snakes. And I think there are probably two primary reasons that this fear tends to be so powerful, and I suppose we can unpack each of them. And I think the first real reason that we fear public speaking is that we just have a deep-seated fear of rejection, that we are afraid that we're going to get up in front of a group who is expecting to hear something fantastic, and they're not going to hear something fantastic, and we're going to be rejected in some way, shape, or form. And I think the second reason that we tend to have this really common fear of public speaking, of public address, of speaking to a group, is that we often think that we don't have anything to say. And there are a lot of causes for that, perhaps because some of the most vocal voices are not always the most accommodating voices, and so we're not always willing to get into the mix. But I think that fear of rejection and that misguided belief that we have nothing to say really undergird this common fear of public speaking.
Yeah, I would support that completely. I mean, I think the when you think of sort of core human needs, the kinds of things that human beings need to feel okay about themselves, to adapt to the challenges in life, to fulfill their potential. Among those are profound needs for to belong to a group, to be accepted for one's capacities, talents. So speaking in front of people creates a particular bind in that regard, because if you get up and blow it, the fear is that those core needs not only won't get met, but you'll experience one of the most profound emotional experiences people can experience, which is that of shame. So to have other people, being embarrassed is when you know you've done something wrong or bad or whatever, but to be shamed is to have the experience of other people seeing that you failed or done something wrong. So I think the deep fear behind a lot of this is that, my God, I'm going to get up there, I'm going to make an idiot of myself, and I'm going to have this deep searing experience of shame, and everyone's going to see me have that.
Right. They're going to throw tomatoes. They're going to point their fingers and laugh at you because that ever happens in real life.
Yeah, I've never seen it in 20-some years of teaching. I've never seen tomatoes be thrown.
But, nor have I. But I think you're right that this fear of shame, this fear that we are going to be seen as outside the group, no longer valuable because the spotlight is often literally on us. I think it's powerful. It's probably misguided, but it's powerful.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking of various movies where they show how this is, or somebody coming forward and doing this in the audience. The horror of it is the audience who is watching them screaming in laughter and ridicule, mm-hmm. And there's a reason those kinds of scenes find themselves in movies, because they speak to these really primal fears that human beings have.
Yeah.
Craig Shealy, I'm going to ask you more about shame, if you can remind me to do that.
Sure.
Because I think you bring up some fascinating points in that area. But from an evolutionary psychology point of view, is there something that the field of psychology has gotten to where it's sort of in agreement that as a matter of preservation, there's a reason why we so deeply fear being criticized by others?
Mm.
And public speaking, we think we're setting ourselves up for being judged negatively.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about think in evolutionary terms, think about why are we built to fear criticism so deeply? And a lot of the research that's been done on child development, for example, illustrates the negative impact of when people are exposed to, for example, there's a wonderful body of research called Expressed Emotion that looks at hostility and criticism and emotional over-involvement. And when people are exposed to high levels of that in a family setting, for example, they show a 2 to 3 times higher relapse rate when they've been hospitalized for a psychiatric condition, for example. So there's something about the way that we're built sort of physiologically in terms of our brain functioning, actually, that tends to react in a disorganized way when we're exposed to feedback or perspective, when we see other people, when we have an emotional experience of other people having a rejecting or hostile posture toward us. There are probably a lot of reasons why, group settings, whether it's a family group or a larger community-based group, why it tends to be more adaptive for people to work in a kind, compassionate, warm, facilitative way without that group support, whether it's a little unit like a family or a larger unit like a classroom or a community. The whole infrastructure of adaptation, life, existence, thriving breaks down. So our social and relational fabric depends upon relations that are anything but critical over the long term. And so speaking is a beautiful illustration of a potential threat to that sort of unified, integrated, warm, responsive environment, because it's so public and could be so dramatic and so instant.
And we see a real development of this throughout various stages of our life, where when you're in grade school and high school, you want to do anything but stand out.
Right.
You don't want to be the weird kid in school.
Right.
And then when you get to college and your early career, you want to stand out. You need to make a name for yourself, make yourself appear different.
Right.
But then when it comes to being asked to do some sort of formalized speaking activity, that we have that gut check moment where we say, maybe fundamentally I don't want to stand out too much because of the potential risk involved in it, or at least the presumed potential risk. I don't believe that it has been my experience that in most scenarios, this potential risk is overinflated in the speaker's mind.
Well, let's talk some about your experience, Stephen Lin, because if I understand a little of your biography correctly, even before you became a doctor of communication, in your undergraduate years at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, you had a stellar career as a college debater. I mean, you started as a freshman. You did that for 3 years. In your fourth year, you actually were coaching this debate team that traveled around the country and won all kinds of national awards. Did you find it easy? Were you one of the exceptions that the first time you spoke, you stepped in front of a microphone, there's no fear, or did you have some work to do?
You know, those who know me well know that it is not a natural inclination for me to be an outspoken, outgoing person. Yet for some reason, I find myself in settings where I'm continually being outspoken and outgoing. And so debate was a fantastic experience for me that allowed me a practice, a craft that asked me to use the skills that I had been trained to have, that had been instilled in me through a solid education, particularly through the debate program at Liberty. Fantastic coaching program. And so the activity allowed me to take on those moments of vocalized argumentation that I don't know that I would naturally want to do, but I really felt empowered when I was able to do it. We were successful. My debate partner and I did pretty well on the varsity circuit, and that was, you know, that's really rewarding to be able to voice an argument and have it received well, and to receive accolades for your ideas that you've shared out there with an audience.
Was it being part of a team that helped?
Sure. Sure, yeah. There's a
kind of harking back to what Craig was just saying, our psychologist here today, that feeling social connections and not feeling totally isolated and in the spotlight.
Yeah, the type of debate that I did, the type of debate that Liberty is pretty successful in, is called policy debate. And policy debate is different than some other forms of debate because you have a partner. You have a debate partner where it's two people against two people in a given debate round. And having that partnership was a really... At times, challenging part, of course, to the activity, but it can also be a really reassuring part because you've got someone there carrying half the load and able to serve as a check against the errors that you make that might otherwise cause you some sort of failing. You've got someone else there watching your back, and that, you know, on a fundamental level, that's really reassuring.
Hmm. Yeah, it almost sounds analogous to doing co-therapy, for example, where you can. One person takes the lead for a while and is engaged in the communication back and forth, whereas the other can watch for aspects of the process that you're missing as the one who's formally engaged. So you're seeing how other people are reacting. You're imagining other questions that could be there. That's really, really fascinating. So.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I have I try to instill in my students now when I'm doing communication training with students. I try to encourage them to practice their presentations with an actual audience before the real occasion, mm-hmm. because they can get positive feedback, they can get helpful feedback from real people that can reassure them, and it kind of takes you out of this hyper negative mental state that we can get ourselves in when we focus on our fears too much, mm-hmm. and it has real people that can be really reassuring, mm. and help guide your ideas in a more productive path, mm. than what our brains sometimes want to guide them towards.
We're going to hit the break in just about a minute, but I got to ask you, Stephen Lind, is it possible that as someone in their late teens that you started working on this debate team traveling around the country, appearing before audiences of strangers, that one of the things that you learned is now what you teach other people, that for debate, there was an awful lot of preparation.
Absolutely.
And now what you're telling people for any kind of public speaking situation is you can ease your fears if you spend a lot of time preparing?
The fundamentally best way that a person can improve their public speaking and really reduce their anxiety is to prepare, prepare, prepare. The more knowledgeable you are on your subject, the more rehearsed you are, the more likely you are to nail it.
Psychologist Craig Sheely, Executive Director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, is one of our guests. Sitting next to him, communication scholar Stephen Lind, currently serving as a visiting professor at Washington and Lee University. And when we get back from the break, we're going to speak with somebody who's spent some significant time coaching presidential candidates to do better in debate and their public speaking. So I suspect we're going to get some tips from him, too. We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. I mentioned some of these questions earlier, but in case you listening have just tuned in or you heard the questions before but forgot that we are looking for your response, who would you say qualifies as one of the most effective communicators you have ever seen? Have you ever been in an audience, small or large, and just found yourself wowed by the person standing up in front of the group? What was it about him or her that really impressed you? 888-WMRA-TALK, that's 888-967-2825, how to reach us by phone. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Here in the Insight studio right now, clinical psychologist Craig Sheely, as well as communication scholar Stephen Lind, and my name's Tom Graham. And joining us now by phone, a man who served as a debate teacher and coach at Liberty University for almost two decades, leading his teams to many, many national championships until his work got the attention of some powerful people in Washington, D.C. in the early 2000s. And he ended up serving as President George W. Bush's debate coach during the 2004 election, has since worked with many other high-profile political candidates and business leaders. He now runs his own communication consulting firm in Northern Virginia. Brett O'Donnell, welcome to Virginia Insight.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Brett, we've been talking about fear of public speaking, and a little bit we're going to talk about how to get past it and become excellent. But let's stick with this fear of public speaking theme for the moment. With the high-profile people that you have coached over the past decade, do any of them fear getting in front of an audience, or has it just become old hat?
Well, for many of them, it's old hat. You'd be surprised that some of the clients I work with are still pretty apprehensive before they stand in front of crowds, particularly when there's a lot on the line and they're standing in front of millions of people. I face that with presidential candidates who are doing debates in front of literally millions of people.
So if you can get them to relax and feel comfortable, it's got to work for us. What do you tell them? What do you teach them?
Well, one of the first things that, you know, I would tell any apprehensive communicator is to not think of it like a public speaking situation, but rather think of it like an enlarged conversation. And so if you're communicating to a camera or communicating to an audience, find a couple of friendly faces or make the camera into a friendly face and think of it as a conversation, because we tend to be most comfortable communicating when we're talking one-on-one with people that we know and we know love us. And so if we can find someone in the audience or a few people in the audience that are giving you positive feedback and carry on a conversation with them, then it will tend to relax you. So thinking of it not like a public speech, but more like a conversation can help put people at ease.
Do people tell you that they're actually able to do that?
Yeah, you know, I actually had a presidential candidate who I worked with a few years ago who would find a couple of folks in the audience that he knew, and he would actually debate to them. So much so that after the debate, it would be very obvious that he had been talking with them almost directly.
That wasn't a fellow by the name of.
But the audience never knew it.
That wasn't a fellow by the name of John McCain, was it?
It actually was. So, yeah. John Senator McCain would get very nervous before debates, and you would think a person who had been standing in front of people all of his life would be very confident, but. You know, when there's a lot on the line and you're standing in front of millions of people, even the best and most proficient public speakers feel some apprehension. And so he would talk with a few folks in the audience that he could find as friendly faces, and it would help him. You know, the one thing I'd say, though, is apprehension in communication is actually a good thing. When we are afraid, our senses are at their greatest. And so you tend to be a more competent communicator when you have a little apprehension going into a public speaking situation. And You know, it's actually not normal, I think, for most people, given the fact that fear of public speaking is the number one fear in the country. It's really not normal for folks to feel no anxiety before they stand up to speak. It's perfectly normal. Even the best communicators will feel a little apprehension, some significant apprehension, before they stand up to give a speech or do a debate or make a television appearance.
Yeah. Hey there, Craig Sheely here. I just had a sort of a question for you. Have you ever worked with somebody at the sort of the level that you have where their level of fear is such that it simply could not be overcome by whatever approaches, methods, techniques, coaching that you were able to provide?
No, I haven't had anyone who just absolutely melted down. I have had people who, I had one person who literally was refusing to go out and do a primary debate. And I just had to resort to authority and say, you will go out and do the debate. And they went out and did a fantastic job, but they were so apprehensive before the debate that they were almost refusing to go. So, I haven't had anyone who's completely melted down. I have experienced that in classes. I've had students faint and others who flee the room or just refuse to give their speech because they're so nervous about giving it in public.
Yeah, I had a student one time get up to give a speech, and she started crying because she was so nervous about the experience. So I had her sit down, try again in a few minutes, and unfortunately she started crying again. So near the end of the class, we had her try one more time, and she started crying the third time, bolted out of the classroom, and I never heard from her again. probably speaks to my poor preparation, but definitely speaks to her high level of apprehension as well.
Yeah. I had a student once who was a basketball player on the basketball team, and he just could not make it through his speech, and so I went up and stood beside him, and we did the speech and interview form, and he managed to make it through. But, it was amazing that he could go on the basketball court and play in front of thousands of people, but could not stand in front of 20 of his classmates and give a speech. And so, you know, you have to find different ways. You know, people experience different levels of apprehension, and it's almost like wading into a pool. If you can get them to get their feet wet, then you can get them to get a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper. But some folks are never willing to actually put their feet into the water. And so they never, and I suspect that's what happened with the student in your class, Stephen. And so I'm sure that that's why she ran out of the room.
Yeah, we shoved her into the deep end. Whoops.
Well, Brett O'Donnell, I understand that your schedule is pretty hectic today, and we only have you on the line here for a couple of more minutes. So we will, in a few moments, get back to helping with fear, since we've got a psychologist and a communication scholar in the studio. But the other question I wanted to make sure that we ask you, Brett, before you had to go, is once you get somebody past the fear so that they're willing to appear in front of audiences, you then teach them some strategies for how to be especially effective. Tell us some about that.
Well, absolutely. And in my world, and in the world of public speaking, you know, audiences are the key. Everything we do communicatively has to be matched to an audience. We don't communicate in a vacuum. We communicate with the intention of reaching someone or many people. And so I try to teach my clients about the concept of audience, and that at a basic level, it's all about effective messaging. It's all about designing a message that will reach an audience. And the first thing that assumes is that you have a message. You'd be surprised that even in my field, I'll work with political candidates, and one of the first questions I will ask them is, why are you running for the office you seek? And you'd be surprised how many candidates can't articulate an answer to that question. And so having, and by the way, there's a classic example of this. back in 1980 when Ted Kennedy sought the Democrat nomination for the presidency, Roger Mudd asked him in a 60 Minutes interview why he wanted to be president. And his answer was so poor that it basically ruined his candidacy before it even got off the ground. And so, you know, audiences will only remember one or two basic things from a communication experience, be it a debate, a speech, a television appearance, an interview. And so the importance of having a message and driving that message through a communication experience is incredibly important. That's why, you know, sort of the Dale Carnegie approach to communication is tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them what you told them. That's the whole notion of driving message. And so I work with my clients in detail about how to drive message and what the constituents of an effective message are. And we talk about couching message in narrative form, that people love to hear stories. If you go out with someone for dinner or, you know, for a social setting, you end up usually telling stories to that person about your experiences, and that's what carries message. And so better than communicating in just a few talking points or throwing out some statistics, carrying message in narrative form is really important. People will become more attached to a story about a concept rather than if you just try and explain a concept.
Brett, let me see if I'm getting what sounds to me like three key points here. One sounds like it is related to what we were hearing from Stephen Lind earlier, and that is preparation is all important. And a subset, what you're telling us about preparation is make sure that you know what you want to get across. Have a message.
Exactly.
And the second thing is instead of having a 12-page policy idea that you want people to listen to, have it boiled down to some simple points that it's easy for people to remember. So
That's right.
A message, have a simple way of getting it across, and then the third point is if you've got a simple message that you can exemplify in a story, tell a story?
Absolutely. You know, in the last couple of weeks, the sort of the big issue that is occupying the center of a lot of Americans' lives right now is Obamacare. And there have been numerous articles written with statistics and facts about what Obamacare is and what's happening and what have you. But last week in the Wall Street Journal, there was the story of a woman in California who has cancer, a fairly aggressive form of cancer, and is losing her health insurance. And that story managed to resonate so significantly that she has appeared on most of the major networks, on all of the cables, and her story has been really used to exemplify what's happening in the debate over Obamacare. And so the story has been much more potent than any fact or figure could be. And that's not to say that you shouldn't have statistics or evidence for your claims that you make in a speech or a debate, but having a story brings those facts and figures to life. It makes it real in the minds of the listener, in the audience's mind, because after all, if you can tell a story about how your message directly affects people, then an audience will assume that it can affect them as well. And so it makes an issue, it makes the message much more salient in the lives of the listeners because they understand how it impacts their lives personally.
Brett O'Donnell is president of the consulting firm O'Donnell & Associates, based in Alexandria, Virginia. He has coached candidates for a number of presidential campaigns, and as you may be able to tell from what we've heard from Brett so far, he tends to focus on helping Republican candidates for office. Brett, thank you so very much for making time for us here on Virginia Insight.
You're very welcome. Good to be with you.
So for me, it happened in sixth grade when I was on stage in elementary school production of the play Tom Sawyer. That's when I got a major lesson about dealing with the fear of public speaking, and I can tell you all more about it sometime if you'd like. But right now, I'm hoping to hear your story. Got a tale you're willing to tell about when you were up in front of an audience, what happened for you, and what you learned from it? by phone. We're at 888-WMRA-TALK on Facebook. You can post to us at WMRA's Virginia Insight. So what we were hearing from professional communication consultant Brett O'Donnell, let's turn to our psychologist, Craig Shealy. You want to give us an analysis there of why what Brett does seems to work so well?
I think you know, essentially what we're talking about here is, from a psychological perspective, is the, again, looping back to where we began, the fundamental fear of sort of being ashamed, being experienced by others as being incompetent, being alone. So I think a lot of what he does is he joins people. The example he gave of the basketball player, for example, why did that work? Well, why did his example of McCain work? Well, what was happening there is that in each of those instances, a relational connection was made between the person who was to be doing the speaking and another human being. In McCain's case, it was people in the audience that he knew were friendly. And that was a soothing experience for him. And the same with a basketball player. He was able to relate to one other person. So the, you know, sort of when I think of from a psychological perspective, what could be helpful here is to just recognize what's really going on. You know, why are people afraid of this? And again, it's this desperate fear that human beings have of being ridiculed, exposed, shamed, and all of the techniques he talked about, in addition to the bread and butter aspects, mm-hmm. as Stephen said, of preparation, for example, and there are other sort of concrete things like that. But for people to keep in mind just how deeply common and shared this fear is, that all human beings feel this to a degree.
Yeah, that can actually be rather empowering for a speaker, knowing that you're not the only one who has this really common aversion to getting up in front of a group.
Right.
But
actually,
some people make it look so easy.
Yeah. There's a myth of the naturally gifted, charismatic speaker, mm-hmm. which is usually not so natural and a whole lot more learned. And sometimes we learn it because we're in a situation where our family is charismatic and outgoing, and so we can learn it by natural imitation. Other times, like in the case of Brett's clients, it takes very specific training in order to kind of hone the best aspects of a speaker so that they're not a cookie cutter model of a speaker, but rather their best traits as a communicator are able to be brought to the forefront, enabling them to really connect with an audience, to really identify with them, which is that opposite side of that shame. The shame is that we're afraid we're not going to connect. And if you can bring out the best in a speaker and allow them to actually connect, well, that can be really powerful for all communicators.
888-WMRA-TALK, our phone number. Frank in Harrisonburg is joining us. Frank, we're getting close to the break, but we're hoping to at least hear your question before we hit it.
I don't know that this is a question, but simply a comment. And I'm a member of a Toastmasters here in Harrisonburg, a public speaking forum organization that teaches public speaking to novices and professionals. And I just would like your friends or your guests' comments on Toastmasters. Mm. And I'm going to give a little blurb because we will meet Thursday night, this Thursday, at National College here in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Frank, thank you very much for that. I wouldn't be surprised if there are other people in the audience who've had experience with Toastmasters. And if you have, we'd love to hear whether that was a help to you or if there's anything else that you've learned about communicating effectively. Give us a call at 888-967-2825. If you have a specific fear about public speaking that maybe we could help you with, we'd love to hear from you, too. It's just you speaking into the phone to very helpful, friendly people. We'll be back in a minute. For the first 3 years of his undergraduate work at Liberty University, Stephen Lind was a member of that school's championship debate team. In his senior year, he helped coach that team. Later, after a doctorate in communications at Clemson, Stephen spent some time in private industry as a communication consultant. These days, he's serving as a visiting professor of business administration at Washington and Lee University. Craig Shealy is both director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, based at Mary Baldwin College, as well as a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University. And then in his spare time, he has a private practice as a clinical psychologist. We have some hardworking people here who are talking about communication skills as well as overcoming fear of public speaking. 888-WMRA. Talk is how to reach us by phone if you'd like to speak with them. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Craig Sheely, let's talk some more about shame.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, again, this is, if you think of think for a minute of the most powerful emotional response that human beings can have. Whether or not, for example, to bring up a graphic example, you believe O.J. Simpson did what he did or not. An example of that was what theoretically caused the reaction that he had was an intense experience of shame. He felt publicly humiliated, and it brought him to a state of rage, which ultimately, if again you believe this is how this went, led to that kind of explosive, violent act. So it's hard to imagine when you think of children who are shamed on the playground and the just body level racking that you will see when a child reports, you know, this happened to me, and their whole being just collapses. You get an idea of how extremely powerful that experience can be. And I really think that's what's happening. That's at the core of why it's so difficult for people to get up, because mm-hmm. they have this fundamental fear. But
I understand fear of being embarrassed and not wanting to experience the possibility of being judged in a negative way, of being criticized, of being found lacking when I stand up in front of an audience and try to communicate. But it sounds to me, Dr. Craig Sheely, like shame is something that goes much deeper.
Yeah, I think there are fundamental emotions. That's one of them, and it's core to our development. It's core to our the avoidance of shame, creating situations where we attend to in child development or in the classroom, where we attend to the experience of our students as faculty, for example, with a real sense of empathy for just how on the spot human beings can feel, to the point that they can't even reflect on what it is that they're feeling. They simply are the feeling.
So it sounds like one of the things that you are recommending and that Stephen Lind is recommending when it comes to getting past this deep-seated emotion or fear of experiencing this deep-seated emotion is some sort of encouragement to understand that other people understand.
Yeah.
I think you're going to end up standing Stephen Lind in front of a group of other human beings who are very likely to have empathy with you because they fear standing in front of a group of people speaking.
Yeah, most of the time the folks in the audience would prefer that you're the one up on the stage.
Well, I'm going to ask you more about that, but we've got some calls coming in, so let's go next to Bridgewater. Linda, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Stephen Lind and or Craig Sheely. Are you there, Linda?
Appreciate your talking about this issue because it speaks to me, and it's just so ironic that I heard it now. But anyway, it's my job to speak in public, and it's not getting any easier. I always think that I'm prepared. But when I get up there and see folks looking at me, I freeze. And I really am not I don't think I'm aware of what I'm saying. And I also, it's worse for me if I know people in the audience. So looking for a friendly face is the first.
Okay, Dr. Lind, let's do some diagnosing and helping.
Yeah, that's really interesting that the common parties of the audience are not your most comfortable. I think that what you said about feeling underprepared is really common. But the truth is, I dare say that you would feel that much stronger had you not literally prepared for the presentation. So I think, and Brett was saying this too, that a certain level of apprehension is normal and can actually be a good thing. You'll hear performers saying this a lot. Like, you'll hear an interview of Beyonce or Taylor Swift, and they'll be asked, do you get nervous before you go on stage? And the answer is almost routinely, well, sure I do. And that means I care. And so I think your feeling of apprehension is not something that you should try to avoid at all cost. Instead, recognizing that it's a natural part of every speaker and can actually be the natural part of some of the best communicators. I think, can be liberating for us as speakers. And so I'd encourage you to not get yourself too paralyzed by realizing that you still have a level of apprehension at each presentation.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to try that.
Linda, I guess I'd just be curious, you know, when you freeze, as you say you do, is there a fear in your head? I mean, what's going on for you when you have that experience?
I think what's going on is I'm thinking, uh-oh, it's happening again.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you get in a state where you're shut down and do you literally at that point, behaviorally, you're not able to speak?
Well, I am speaking, but I think I'm not staying. I can have all the notes in the world, but I'm not able to even think through going to my notes. Mm. It's just that overall sense of, uh-oh, my face is turning red. Mm. Uh-oh, I stuttered a little bit. And then it's downhill from there.
Mm.
One of the suggestions that I give to speakers, and it's going to sound too simple, but just physically, anatomically, it works, is to literally take a deep breath. Mm. Those deep breaths seem like a trite suggestion, but they just chemically work for us. They help regulate our heartbeat. They help get more oxygen to the brain. And they can give us that really necessary pause where we allow ourselves to not say something for a second or two. And the audience typically isn't going to mind. And that deep breath then allows us to relax ourselves.
Mm. And
that could be really helpful. And before you speak, this is a neat little trick that I often tell folks to do because it's not noticeable. If you take your fingertips and you put your thumb to your thumb and your fingers to your fingers and you press really hard together for a 3, 4, 5 second count and then release them and let your arms fall by your side, that can release some of that excess chemical energy in your muscles and can help physically relax you as well. And that's something you can do before you get up on stage or even while you're standing behind the lectern to help calm you without anybody even noticing.
Okay.
Linda, I don't know if this is going to help or not, but since you're getting such expert advice, I feel compelled to try and offer something. I love community theater, and I recall years ago meeting a guy at an audition who just was cold reading a part of a script and was absolutely wonderful at it. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, what makes you so different from everybody else here? And he said, okay, I'm going to tell you my secret. I allow myself to stutter.
Mm-hmm.
That in reading a script, what most people do is feel like they have to get the words perfectly. Mm-hmm. And then they just don't sound like real human beings. Mm-hmm. And so when you're on stage or even when you're reading a script out loud for the first time, you have to have pauses in weird places. You have to be able to stutter a little bit because that's how real human beings speak.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
It sounded to me like when you're worried about stuttering or turning red, that you're worried that you're not doing it perfectly. And
right.
Since my experience with that particular actor, I've spoken to any number of professional actors who say something quite similar, mm-hmm. that you have to allow yourself even to plant in mistakes
right. So
you sound like you're a human being.
Okay.
I hope some of this helps. Thank you so very much for sharing your experience with us. I know that there are lots of people listening who identify exactly with what you've been saying.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
so
Linda.
We have here in the Insight Studios psychologist. See, I'm stuttering already, but I'm not doing it on purpose.
It's totally natural. Feel free.
Psychologist Craig Sheely, Executive Director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, and communication scholar Stephen Lind, currently serving as a visiting professor at Washington and Lee University. We're talking about communication, getting over fear of doing it in public, and even how to get really good at doing it. We've only got a couple more minutes to take calls, but we do have some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. We're going next to Winchester. Ralph, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, so when I was in junior college, I did my first time ever speaking in front of I had a public speaking class, and the teacher said, right in the middle of my speaking, don't stand on that lectern. It has feeling on its legs. You know, legs branch out at the bottom. Don't stand on those legs. It has feelings, too. Critiqued me right in the middle of my speaking. So I was very, you know, uptight and, you know, didn't like speaking in front of people. But I was always many times in front of people because I was receiving an award for track and cross country and stuff. So I had an exposure that way. And then when I got into a four-year school, Well, after I graduated from my four-year school, to get into grad school, you had to read something.
Mm.
And I didn't want to, you know, not know what I was reading. So I already had a poem memorized, and so I just looked down at my book, and I just said, if you can't be a pine in the top of the, on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the desolate pine on, you know. So I had it all memorized, and I just look up at the audience every once in a while like I was, you know, getting eye contact and stuff. So, and then later on,
Ralph, before you give us too many more stories, it sounds to me like at some point you got past your fear. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was there anything?
The way I got past my fear was I in our spokesman's club, which was patterned after Toastmasters International. We would have like this first speech was an icebreaker, and then you get into a color speech, and then you get into a tax speech, and so forth. And so all those things, and those were critiqued by your peer, by people in our church, but it was all done in love. So you had a warm audience there. That
Ralph, thank you so much. It sounds like part of what we're hearing is back to what you were saying, Craig. If you're going to practice in front of a group of people that you know are going to be there for you in a positive way. We're going next to, I think, Las Vegas. This is Frank. Frank, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Are you in Nevada?
No, actually, I'm in Virginia right now, but I live in Las Vegas.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, thanks for calling in while you're visiting. Your question or comment for Stephen Lind and or Craig Sheely, please.
Well, I just have really a comment. I do a lot of speaking as part of my my job, and I've been doing it for many years now, about 30 years. And, you know, it's funny. People at the beginning used to say to me that I was a natural, but you know, I was always really apprehensive in the beginning, but what I found out was that if I really focused on the passion of my message, if I really focused on my message with the idea that, you know, I really got to communicate this well, people really have to understand. And then as I go through, I look to the faces to see if people are understanding. And if I see they're understanding, that gives me confidence. If I think they don't seem to be following or understanding, then I focus even more on the passion of delivering that message.
Yeah,
that works for me.
That self-awareness can be really powerful, knowing what you're passionate about and knowing what your strengths are as a speaker. That can be really powerful for your development.
Frank, thank you so much for sharing that with us here on Virginia Insight. We're close to out of time, Stephen Lind, but I want to circle back to something that you mentioned right near the top of the hour, that people, one of the reasons that we can be hesitant to stand up and speak is, I think you said, sometimes the most vocal voices are not the most accommodating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tell us more about that.
Well, unfortunately, we have some cultural trends that make us resistant to listening. We are not as trained at being good, active, open listeners. And instead, we often find that, whether it be in politics or theological discussions, that we have strong voices that are not open to considering alternative perspectives. And that can make the folks who are maybe still questioning or maybe don't feel as confident as of a communicator, it can cause them to have what's often to be part of what's often called the spiral of silence, where you think you're not supposed to talk, and so you don't talk, and then that makes it so that you talk even less, and then the other people that are like you don't talk either. And I think the corrective to that is to begin individually working on being more open, bilateral communicators, where we can have strong opinions, but we're also willing to consider other opinions that might challenge ours, might mean that we're wrong at certain times, but really accommodates a diversity of voices.
And Craig Sheely, I suppose I should not be surprised, coming from a psychologist, let alone coming from you, who've been kind enough to be with us a number of times over the years here on Virginia Insight. It seems to me that the bottom line I'm hearing from you about overcoming fear and being effective as a communicator, in both cases, you're talking about compassion?
Well, yeah, and yes, I think so. And building on the comment that Stephen just made, I mean, as much as important it is to be an effective speaker, I think actually being an effective listener is the other side of that same coin.
Right.
So cultivating the capacity to really hear and feel what other people are saying, and showing them through your words, and deeds, that they matter, that what they have to say is important, can be a really important lesson to you about what matters most as a speaker, as somebody who has to get up. You know what it's like to have the experience of being heard, cared for, that the compassion that Tom speaks to. Knowing that, having some compassion for yourself, mm-hmm. The fear that is normal within you that's so widespread, one of the most common phobias people have, reflecting on that, and then asking people that care for you to listen to you when you have to practice something and to give you feedback, as difficult as that can be. If you're in a trusting relationship, I would strongly recommend that step.
Our guests have been Stephen Lind, communication researcher and visiting professor of business administration at Washington and Lee University, as well as Craig Sheely, clinical psychologist, professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University, and head of the Virginia-based International Beliefs and Values Institute. Plus, earlier in the broadcast, communication consultant and former debate coach to both George W. Bush and John McCain's presidential campaigns, Brett O'Donnell. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yep.
You can find postings of Virginia Insights on the Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org. When you get to that page, you will find links to more information about the work our guests are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.